Okay, welcome and thanks for listening to Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. I'm Dr. Jodie Park.
And I'm Rose Mackey, and we are private practice social workers who work in the child protection and trauma fields. And today we are recording on two lands. I'm on Darawa land and Jodie is on Ewan land, I believe.
Yes, that's true, because we're not in the same place today. For the first time, we're trying to do this in different locations.
So we'll see how we go. We're in New South Wales, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So please follow our podcast. Please also follow us on Facebook and Instagram and send us any questions, comments, practice stories, or conundrums that you have. We'd love to talk about them on our podcast. Our email is relationalpractice, all one word, 01@gmail.com. You can remain anonymous. If you're happy for your name to be read out, we can do that as well. Yeah. And Jodie will put the email address in the description where you find your podcast.
Absolutely. So today, for the first time, we are trying to do a recording via Zoom because we are trying to see whether we can get some video happening. We've had lots of feedback about people wanting a video option. It's certainly not our favourite. And we are both, you know, in our very first episode, Rose called us two old bats, and that's kind of what we are. So we are relying very heavily on Angus Pinkstone, who is the editor and is the guru who keeps us in line in terms of what we're doing, to see if we can work this out. But anyway, sideline issue that is. Thank you very much for joining us today. We are going to, this is kind of part two of our conversation about attachment. So if you remember from the last episode, episode four, we introduced the theory of attachment. And we kind of tried to describe the different attachment styles and basically where they came from. So how did all that come about? Today we wanted to extend that conversation a little bit by really linking attachment theory to our practice. So talking about our practice experiences in the hope that it kind of is something that will help you in your own practice.
The more I talk about attachment theory or attachment in practice or my practice and am asked questions by my supervisor, which is no surprise to you, it's Jodie. Put an attachment lens on that. The more I talk about it, the more confident and comfortable I am in expressing attachment theory in my work and in being wrong, in seeing things from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And just nice to have gentle reminders when you're in this work about, hang on, you know, what about this stage of the lifespan? What's happening in the relationships in this particular point in time? And is it the same, you know, as what you might have read about them, their earlier life, you know, an earlier life stage they had, or what's happening when they're, you know, coming to you as a professional? Are they automatically trusting you? Are they not? All of those conversations just help us continue to evolve in our practice.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said lifespan, because when I was thinking about what we talked about last time, we focused a lot on children because I guess the practice of attachment theory, I think, focuses a lot on children and that parent-child relationship or that carer-child relationship. But attachment is a lifespan developmental process. And I think, Rose, you did say it last time that it can change. It can absolutely change. And that is, I guess, part of what you hope out of life, that the way that you are when you're 10 is not the way that you are when you're 20 and not the way that you are when you're 30 and 40 and so on. We're always changing. We're always evolving. And so is our attachment process.
Yes. And I think last episode I said that Mary Ainsworth might have been English. She's not. She was an American-Canadian developmental psychologist. So I just wanted to jump on here and clear that up, because I had a look last night and I was like, you idiot, Rose. Completely wrong. Not at all English. Don't know where I got that from. So she was American-Canadian and, a developmental psychologist, whereas John Bowlby was a psychiatrist.
You know, I just believed you. You said English. I went, okay, that sounds fair.
See, that's why I had to correct myself. Misinformation out there.
Yeah, fine. I mean, I think you said it because you say it with such conviction, as I say stuff with such conviction, and people go, oh, she knows what she's talking about. And I have to go, I don't always know what I'm talking about.
No, neither do I, clearly.
It's funny. All right, so I think we finished off last episode with a really great example, Rose, that you gave.
Yes, of two carers that I had met and assessed to become kinship carers for their niece,
yeah,
and how they had changed their attachment styles and their internal working models had changed over time.
I don't know. Would it be useful, do you think, Rose, to just quickly go back over that example?
I don't think it would be useful, but I think what would be useful is for Jodi, you to talk about your example of a similar but very different situation that you've encountered.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I'm going to talk a little bit about a practice example, which is an example of how our attachment style can change when someone experiences a reparative relationship. And so a reparative relationship is a healing relationship, a relationship that helps you to kind of test and develop a new attachment style with the assistance of somebody else, because you kind of need, and I think I know it's in Richard Rose's life story workbook, but I don't know if he's the one who originally said this, but please forgive me, Richard, if it was you. But you know that someone, maybe Richard Rose, said that if you are harmed by relationships, then you actually need a relationship experience to undo the harm. And that's what reparative caring is all about. That term, reparative caring, that's what it means. It really means using a relationship in an intentional healing way. So the example I'm going to give is of a grandparent couple who were applying for care of their granddaughter who had recently entered the foster care system. They had already been knocked back. So the assessment was initially conducted by an agency assessor, a carer assessor, a foster care agency assessor who said that, no, these people were not suitable, not because of what came out in the assessment, because the assessment was actually never finalized. It was stopped halfway through, but because of the grandfather's history. And so I'll explain that. So that's how I became involved, because the grandparents were very strong advocates for themselves and very strong advocates for their granddaughter. And they said, we actually don't accept that. We want there to be an external assessor, someone external to this whole process. The matter was also in children's court at the time, who can I guess, an unbiased view. They felt like the agency assessor was quite biased. Whether she wasn't, I don't know, but that was what they felt. So that argument was something that the Children's Court agreed with, and that's how I became involved. So a little bit about the grandfather. So the grandfather was a man who, for the first 18 years of his life, experienced significant harm. And spent most of his childhood, after being removed from his parents, in an orphanage. So he was not adopted out. He was placed in an orphanage in kind of central New South Wales. And he was really kind of used and abused most of his life. He didn't go to school. He wasn't allowed to go to school. And as soon as he was old enough, he was put to work. He was kind of sent to farms to be a farmhand. So that was his experience from 0 to 18. Grandma, on the other hand, had a really quite what you'd imagine a normal childhood experience to be. She had really strong relationships with her family. She could recount there being times where things were stressed, because families are stressed sometimes, but you know, nothing that would indicate that she experienced any abuse or neglect herself. So somewhere along the line, these two people met, and they then had their own children. So granddad, and they tell this story so, so passionately, the grandparents. More so grandma, because granddad doesn't say a lot. But grandma, but he's there. He sat there for every interview and agreed, but grandma did most of the talking. And that's part of the issue that the agency had, that they felt like grandma was controlling and that she kind of called the shots in the relationship, because granddad didn't say much during the assessment process. But as it turned out, he didn't say much during the assessment process, because He was so afraid of what to say because he did not want to be judged, because that's actually what happened to him. Throughout that whole initial assessment process, he was judged really for being abused as a child, because that's what was used against him. So the initial assessment basically didn't proceed on the grounds that because of the grandfather's childhood experiences, it would mean that he experienced trauma, and that he did not acknowledge that trauma in the way that they wanted him to acknowledge, and that he hadn't dealt with that trauma. Basically, that was what they said. I kind of disagreed with that view, because I talked to the
God. I'm sitting here burning inside, and yeah. I've heard this story before, but my God.
Well, I guess the way that I kind of approached the situation is that I was really interested in the relationship between the grandparents and what that meant for granddad. Was that a reparative relationship or not? And so I asked questions about their relationship and what that looks like, starting from when they first met to now. And as it turned out, granddad actually was his whole attachment schema was significantly different as this kind of 60-odd-year-old man than what it was when he was a teenager, because of the relationship with grandma. She taught him how to actually have a relationship again. She taught him how to actually experience love and to give love. He's still a traumatized man. He still had that trauma. It doesn't go away. So he's still kind of, there are times where it was kind of one step forward, two steps back. But the difference is that he now knows how to actually experience love. One of the other things that I did that they didn't do initially, and this isn't about how good I am, how bad they were. That's not the argument. It's just about it's about approaching a situation from a different angle, I guess, and applying an attachment lens to making sense of what it is that you're seeing. So one of the other things that I did is I asked the adult children what it was like to be parented by grandma and granddad. And I remember talking to, there was three children. I remember talking to all of them, but one specifically really stuck with me, and that was the middle daughter. And when I asked her that question and I explained why I was asking that question, you know, I was really interested in her experience of being parented by her parents. She started to cry, and she said no one has ever asked her that before. And she told a story of a really honest, genuine story of what it was like to be parented. And she talked about that they all knew that dad struggled at times with feelings and with emotions, but they also knew, and that when those struggles were happening, grandma would step in, but they also knew that he loved them and he would reconnect. So if he struggled at times with an emotion, or it wasn't so much with displaying the emotion, it was more about withdrawing from them. That's what it was about. They knew that in a matter of time, he would come back and he would sit down with them and he would explain to them, I'm really sorry that I did that, that I withdrew, that I didn't, and this is the reason why. So she said they grew up understanding that the link between feelings and behaviors, feelings and actions, because that was just part of the psyche of their family.
And it was clearly consistent and predictable. So when dad withdraws or the emotion changes, it's predictable that some point in time there's going to be a conversation about this. Mum's going to step in. Mum's going to, you know, do what she does consistently. And that is that consistent, predictable, reparative relationship, because the repair's happening.
Absolutely. And that's the story that she told. She didn't use that language, but that's the story that she told. And she remembers times when she was a child where her mum would tell the grandfather, would tell dad. So her mum would tell her dad how to approach the situation. She said she could hear, they weren't always privy to the conversations, but they would be listening. And she could hear them having the conversation, and he would be saying, I don't know what to do. And she'd be like, well, why don't you do this? And that actually such strong evidence of how that grandmother practiced everyday reparative care or reparative healing with her husband.
spectacular story that demonstrates, I guess, how you're over your lifespan,
Yeah.
you're such an influence and you are. And if
Yeah.
you think we talked in the last episode about our internal working model,
Yeah.
about this grandfather's internal working model and how alongside of this relationship repair work that grandma's doing, his internal working model is also clearly changing because he's investing in his relationships with his children.
Yes, and his grandchildren. They had more than this one great little granddaughter. They had a whole raft of grandchildren who spent a significant amount of time in the home. It was one of those homes that was really open. There were kids coming in and out all of the time.
Yeah. And I think just going back to my earlier about the story, and it's not about blame, but my feelings are in a statutory child protection system, as practitioners, I really believe we need to have the hope and the knowledge that people can recover from trauma.
Of course.
Children that are abused and neglected, they don't ask for it. They
No,
have
that's right.
nothing wrong. It's what's happened to them.
Yeah.
As a system, when the system is saying we're going to use your childhood experiences against you,
Yeah.
that tells me there's not a great deal of understanding about repair work from trauma. And then where's the hope? And why are we in the child protection arena if we don't believe and know that the theories, and there are a lot of theories and there's a lot of evidence that suggests that reparative care, reparative relationships, they help to recover and repair from traumatic experiences.
Yeah. And I think I was listening when you were talking. I was thinking, I think we blame adults, we blame children, we blame people all the time for experiencing trauma that they had no control over. Think about a kid with quite high externalized behaviors and the labeling that occurs for that child.
For
Yeah.
a woman in a domestic violent relationship
Yes. That's right.
who can't leave because it's so unsafe to leave.
Yeah.
But the blame we attribute to her for often the man's behavior and the
Yeah.
man's.
Yeah. Well, that's a big downer, Rose, but I guess, but it's a good conversation to have, and I think we will have that when we talk about labeling. I guess we need to talk about labeling and language, don't we?
Yeah, I just really want to impress, that we do, and we've talked about power before. We hold a lot of power in this space, and it's about stopping and thinking about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And, how you're analyzing certain situations, or are you just going with the flow? Your manager's told you, we're not assessing these grandparents any further. It's about really using the knowledge and skills you have to be curious and to constantly question, am I on the right track? Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing no harm? And am I giving the opportunity for change?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. How am I understanding what it is that I'm seeing at any given time?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess just on that, I think we're talking about one particular theory of attachment, aren't we? We're talking about, Bowlby's work about that kind of that biological but also emotional kind of experience of attachment. Yep, and then how it kind of transfers to this cognitive experience. But we also need to be understanding that there is more than just one theory of attachment. The other theory of attachment, which I'm not going to go into, to be honest, but I'm just going to name because it is a little bit complicated. But I just want everyone to know that there is another theory of attachment that is called the dynamic maturational model of attachment and adaptation, which I absolutely love. And when I learned about it was like a light bulb went off. And basically, what that model says is that it is a lifespan model. And that model says that we, every single person develops behavioral strategies to manage every relationship we're in. And those strategies can look different from relationship to relationship, and they need to look different from relationship to relationship, and they definitely change over time. However, there is Depending on your experience of a predictable or an unpredictable relationship as an infant, you will have this kind of preference for either inhibiting your emotional context or for externalizing your emotional context. And that preference in terms of how you manage your emotions, so your emotional representation, then transfers heavily to how your behaviors look.
So we are going to talk about that in our next episode. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't feel like I could actually have a proper conversation about it.
Really?
I love it to death, but I have my own interpretation of it's called the DMM model, but for short, I have my own interpretation of the DMM model. And I don't always know if my interpretation is the same as what I learned when I did training on it. But I've kind of interpreted and perhaps changed some of the model to make sense to me. Look, we can have a conversation about it, but I don't feel 100% confident about it. But
Right.
I would suggest strongly that if attachment is something you are interested in, that everybody should look for training on the DMM model, and there is a lot of training on it that you can access, and just go and do some because it's fascinating.
Whose model is it?
So this actually is the model that came from the work of Patricia Crittenden, who was a researcher who did research with Mary Ainsworth. So it's kind of like an extension of Mary Ainsworth's work.
Interconnectedness.
Yeah, and it makes honestly a light bulb moment for me when I did training on it. I was like, this is fascinating, and I wish that I had known this 20 years ago because it explained so much about what it is. It's the presentation of that attachment schema.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So DMM is that model? You want to have it, write that down or have a look at that? I've also done that training and I think it was fabulous, but there is no way I'm having a conversation with Jeremy. I would be the very silent co-host in that podcast because it's not something that I feel at all confident in just speaking about. That's, I need all my books for that.
It's a complex model, isn't it? But then it's not complex. I don't understand why I feel like it's so complex, because then when I'm into it, I'm like, it's so easy to understand. But
And
then
you
I have
can
to.
speak about it like it rolls off your tongue.
Yeah, but like I said, I don't know if that's just my own interpretation or if that's actually what the model says. So anyway, let's not. I'm not confident to talk about that on a podcast.
Let's get to islands then, hey?
Yeah. So what we thought is that we would talk a little bit about. So this is again where we're talking about our own practice and the application of attachment theory in practice, really. And the way that we are looking at attachment theory in these examples is that we are using that as a sense-making process. Yep. So we're using a therapeutic life story work tool called Magic Islands. And therapeutic life story work, I've probably said before, is comes from the work of Richard Rhodes, who is a social worker, a UK social worker. And this activity is part of the suite of tools that you use during the intervention. And what this activity is that you give very clear directions to the child and to the carer about drawing a magic island, and on this island, and they have to have separate islands, and you as the facilitator also need to draw your own island. And on these islands, they can have whatever they like because it's magic. They're in charge of this island, so they can have whoever they like, whatever they like, because it's their island. I give one extra rule, which is that they have to be on the island, because I've had some experiences where the child is not on the island, and I'm like, well, that defeats the purpose of the whole activity. So that wasn't fun. So you give that very clear direction to the child and to the carer, and then as I said before, you draw your own island. The purpose of this activity is to explore attachment relationships. It's to explore attachments by looking at relationships. It's to see who the child puts on the island with them, if anyone. Also, it's about linkages between the two islands, between the carer and the child. It's also about exploring roles, because the questions that you ask the child around their exploration of the island is about what are the rules on this island and what happens if people break the rules. So Rose and I, because we are both therapeutic life story work practitioners, we're going to talk about our experience of using this activity to explore attachments. All right, Rose, do you want to talk first?
Yeah, I'll talk about my little man. So this young man that I worked with, he was about to turn 13, so he was 12 at the time, and he was born quite prematurely and spent the first considerable weeks in hospital after his birth. He was very low birth weight, tested positive for a range of drugs, and was assumed into care a few days after he was born. He had two carers that came to the hospital because he spent such a time in hospital to provide, you know, that touch and nurture to him as much as could do. He was obviously in one of those cribs and all of the machines hooked up. And then upon discharge, he went to a short-term carer. And about at 6 months of age, he went into his long-term foster placement. And that foster placement had a view of adoption. And so I came in when he was 12 and they were exploring adoption or guardianship orders for this young man. He had remained in that same placement. So from 6 months of age until 12, he had remained in his intended long-term placement. So it's really nice when you get the opportunity to work with children and young people that have, you know, not had a whole raft of placement experiences or changes. His foster family, they had a biological son who was older than he was, and was quite young when this little man joined their family. So they were brothers. The young man I worked with, he had a number of maternal and paternal siblings and varying relationships with those people, and varying, I guess, strength or closeness of those relationships too. So I was asked to do therapeutic life story work for him in exploring that, while the agency was exploring what long-term option for him. So he, you know, this is the first or second session I did with him and his carer. We did the Magic Island, and he was eager to, you know, draw this amazing world that he had. And his island was massive, I have to say. It was one of the biggest islands I've seen on the wallpaper. My island was so little because I was trying to, you know, fit it in. And the carer's island, it was a good size, but his was huge. And it was in family, we'll call it his family, they had a very tight-knit group of friends and family that had not had many changes over time. So for his 11 and a half years in this family, his aunties and his uncles and his family friends, they had remained very consistent, but they were very large. So all of his immediate family and all of the pets in that family were on his island, and then the aunties, the uncles, grandparents, school friends, like you name it, this little man had all these people on his island.
Wow.
We had this, well, he drew this magical McDonald's where no one had to work there, but the food was constantly fresh and available. You didn't have to pay for it. It was just magic. It came. And he said, I don't want anyone to have to cook, because then that's, you know, taking time away from me. And then I don't want anyone to clean either. So we'll just put it in. He had this recycling plant going on because he cared about the environment. And whatever the food came in, you know, went into these bins, and, you know, they were recycled. Very thoughtful, very well considered about the impact on other people on his island.
Yeah.
Also had a massive, not into dirt bikes, but a dirt bike track, which anyone could use. The bikes were there. They were well maintained. That was kind of the rule. If you're on the island, you had to, you know, what you used, you had to care for. It was like a collective. My words, not his, but this collective spirit. And had a massive, he was also very much into cars, this massive car wrap ring, I don't know, racetrack. Yeah. Have fun, because he wanted people to have fun. On another part of the island, which was the quiet part, and surrounded by this beautiful calm beach, had campfires so they could roast marshmallows and tell stories and listen to music at night.
Sounds beautiful, doesn't it?
Actually, I was like, the best island I've ever had explained to me, and it's made all of my islands that I've drawn since. I try and like hold myself to that standard. I don't get there. But then on another part of the island, he started drawing all these people, and his carer's like, "Who are these people? Like, we don't know any more people." And he was like, "These are randoms. Random one, random two. We had all these random people." And so in the, the question, how did the random get to the island? Well, anyone can come. Anyone can come to our island. The only rules were that you had to be nice, you had to be respectful, and you had to care for the island. So whatever you used, you helped maintain. You put your rubbish in the bin from Macca's that we were eating for everyone. But that's okay. That's what he wanted. But you could come and go as you please. There was, that was fine. All these, and he said, "They're not going to leave. They're going to want, and that is fine."
Wow.
And his carer's island, she had very similar island, the same people, not the randoms, but the same people on her island. Her island, as well. The rules were something like, be nice to yourself and be nice to others and don't harm the environment. They were kind of, she had very, very simple, basic three rules, which kind of encompassed everything and mirrored his. So this little man, what I interpreted from the activity, and of course reading his history and other conversations, was that he had a pretty secure attachment.
Sounds like it.
He thought the world was pretty safe. He's inviting randoms, come, leave when you want. There's no real authoritarian rules happening there. There's no fearfulness of what these randoms, and the randoms, isn't my word, might bring. Come, come one. Just care for the environment, care for each other. But also, he wanted everyone to have a good time. He wanted people to be roasting marshmallows, telling stories, and listening to music overnight together. That was their together space.
Wow, it just sounds so excited and curious about the world, all his version of the world on that island.
Yeah. There were no sharks. There was no danger. It was very nice. It was probably, minus the bikes and the cars and the Maccas for me, a very nice place that you'd want to go there.
I mean, it is so rare, isn't it, when you do that activity that you actually see that.
So I've never seen it since. And I know when, we were prepping for this podcast, I was like, secure attachment. When have we seen that in? Like, it is hard to, it's not hard to think about that story, but hard to think about all the children, young people you've worked with, how many of them. I can't say there's many that I could say that I would be saying, yep, this is a pretty secure attachment and a very healthy internal working.
I mean, that island suggests that it's a very secure attachment and that it's a very, he feels very comfortable, very safe, very much part of the fabric of that family experience.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
And over, that was very early on in the intervention, over, the number of sessions we did. That was just reinforced that that was actually, what I was seeing, what he was telling me was periods.
Cool. Good example. All right, I'm going to give an example of resistant ambivalent attachment style. So these are the kids we talked about in the last episodes. These are the kids that are kind of like really anxious about relationships, and it's kind of like push pull. Like that's the way I think of it in my own mind. They want relationships desperately, desperately want a relationship, but also are really afraid of that happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So this, I'm going to give this a story of a little boy that I was working with. He was in the process of being adopted when I was working with him. He's since been adopted, but was some months off when I was working with him. He was about 8 years old. He lived with his younger sister and he lived with his adoptive parents that we will call mum and dad. So when he was about three, he was removed from his biological parents. Him and his sister were removed, and they were removed due to really quite intense and significant domestic violence, parental drug use, lots of criminal behavior. It was just really chaotic, really unsafe. And I first started working with him when he was probably about 7, and then he turned 8 during the intervention. And he can remember, he has all of these stories in his brain. He sees them as pictures and he sees them as photos. He can remember a lot about what happened, which is why he was obviously doing life story work and why he was seeing me. So we moved at 3. His sister's a year younger, so she was 2. He was very much his sister's protector in the home. And he will tell stories about how he used to have to put her in wardrobes and hide her. He once hid herself and him in the garbage bin, in the big red garbage bin, just to kind of get away from the violence and from the stuff that was happening. He will tell stories and go into great detail about how he protected them both, but he didn't see it as protecting. That's my word, not his words. But he will just tell stories about what they used to do, what used to happen in the home. So at 3, he then went to a short-term foster carer for I think about 2 years. And that placement was kind of nice for him in a way. It wasn't so nice for the sister, but it was very nice for him because it was his first experience of a safe relationship. But he had very high externalized behaviors, very anxious young man, like a very anxious person, very anxious child. While he was in that short-term 2-year placement, he met mum and dad. He met his adoptive parents, and they started doing respite. And then after 2 years, the both children transitioned to mum and dad and have remained with mum and dad since. So since he was about 5. So when I was when during this activity, he was 8. So we're a few years in. The reason why I was working with him was because clearly there was lots of stuff that was in his brain, lots of stuff that needed to be processed in terms of his previous experiences. But he was also very what's the word? External. He had very strong external behaviors towards mum. Not so much dad, but very much towards mum. But it was very much this push-pull stuff. So he would try and he would want mum next to him and near him. But when she was, he would then do something like hit or kick or spit or push to get her away. He obviously didn't do this every single day, but it was when he was heightened. When he was heightened. But unfortunately, he was heightened a lot of the time. So I probably shouldn't have said he didn't do it every single day because I actually think he did. I actually think he did. Part of the intervention that I was doing with him was therapeutic life story work, but it was also really focusing on the relationship between him and mum and hoping, not hoping, with the aim of helping him to see mum as that safety person, as someone he could actually learn to rely on and trust, because that's what was missing in his experience to date, that he didn't really have an adult. He hadn't experienced that early kind of experience of having an adult to rely on. So we did this activity, and so he was a very creative young man, and he really loved drawing. So he got right into this activity and did not kind of speak for 10 minutes, was just really into drawing his island. So we draw this beautiful, lush-looking tropical island, and on this island there were just the 4 of them in the middle of the island, surrounded by bush, basically, like tropical bush. This family has a lot of relatives, a lot of extended family that are highly involved. So in any given time, he can talk about, his grandparents and his aunties and his uncles and his cousins. None of those people were on the island with him. It was just the 4 of them. Outside of the island, there were sharks, and there were sharks everywhere. And he talked about, and he drew arrows around how the sharks just go around and round and around the island. And during his explanation of his island, the sharks were to keep everyone away, and the middle of the island meant that he could protect everybody from any harm that was coming. It became very clear at that point that he really saw his role was as protecting everybody in that house. He saw himself as the protector for mum and dad instead of seeing mum and dad as the protector for him. So the power of this activity meant that we could then very much work on trying to help him to develop a new narrative around that, which made such a huge difference. Made such a huge difference.
And what about his mum? Did she already know that he had this way to protect him? That was his role, or was that a bit of an eye opener for her?
It was very much an eye opener for her. Very much. Like there was always this view that he had, had obviously protected his sister, but the relationship between him and his sister when they were in this placement with mum and dad was quite aggressive and violent at times. Yeah. And so it was hard for people to think, yes, but if he's protecting her, why is he also hurting her? And that was because that was the only way he knew to protect.
Yeah.
Just how he knew to protect.
What he had learned. That's what his early experiences had probably shown him.
Yeah, but he was also so emotionally overwhelmed that he was just exploding. And some of that aggression was about exploding. Their behaviors towards mum were about exploding. And they're about testing this relationship. What is she going to do? Is today going to be the day where she's going to hit me back?
Yeah. And I think what's really kind of interesting to point out, this is like 3 years into this.
3 years.
And he's still testing.
Very much still testing, very much. This intervention, the life story intervention, was a bit like a light bulb, though. It was like this, you could kind of see throughout the intervention the change in him and his acceptance of mum as this person that could protect him.
Remember that role.
Mum and dad. He was allowing himself to trust mum and dad. Of course, it's going to be a work in progress.
Yeah.
But
the best things about the life story work intervention, isn't it? The amount of time you get to spend and the when you do see the shifts, like how amazing it is to have kind of front row seat into that change.
Yeah, it's really powerful. And it's really such an, I think, an honor to be able to be part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really great.
Shall I give the next example about avoidance? About an avoidant attachment style. So these are the kids that have had experiences of not being able to rely on any adult to meet their needs. So these are the children that are like little islands. They're very self-reliant. They rely on themselves and nobody else, basically. But the way that that presents in behaviors is that it can present as them being kind of a little bit needy, but they're only needy until their needs are met, and then it's like they're dead. Any adult is dead to them. Yeah, it's those children I'm talking about. So this was a girl who was 12 years old, but she was still in year six. So that's kind of important. So she was still in primary school, wasn't in high school yet, because I think there's different pressures when children go to high school. So this girl had been in this placement since about the age of five. She started primary school when she went to this placement. Prior to this placement, she was, for 3 years, so she was in a very abusive foster care placement with a number of children, significant sexual abuse that occurred in that placement against the other children by the male foster carer. She went there when she was one. She left there when she was five. Chances are she was also offended against, but she has no memory of that time in her life at all. No memory at all. From naught to around one, she was with her biological family, experienced significant domestic violence in that family, also parental mental health and drug use. Biological mum was very unwell. Biological dad was often not in the home, but he was also very mentally unwell. So it was very chaotic. So she went from this very chaotic, unsafe environment to this probably very controlled, unsafe environment to this foster care placement with this single female carer who has some expectations of children that are probably outdated. I'm going to put it that way. So we sat down and we went to do this activity. Foster mum didn't want to do it, refused to do it, said, "I don't want to draw. drawing's not my thing. I'm just going to write about my island. And during that exchange that I had with the foster carer, it was interesting to watch how the 12-year-old kind of managed that. She just completely withdrew. You could see there was a change in the way that she was engaged in the session to that point. When foster mum started to argue, it's a little bit like this little girl didn't shut down, but just kind of withdrew. And I think it's because she is very used to foster mum having a different opinion about things, and vocalizing that opinion quite loud, and also being the person whose opinion wins.
No.
Yeah. So she, okay, so we just went, okay, you do that if you want to do that. You know, I'm not going to have an argument with you in front of this child because that is really not the purpose of this intervention, but we'll have a conversation about it another day. So we proceeded with the activity. This little 12-year-old girl, she, and I say little girl, and I know she's 12, but it's because she's quite pseudo immature in a lot of ways. And so some of her presentation is very immature for her age, particularly her emotional and her cognitive presentation. So I know that she's an adolescent or just on the verge of adolescence, but I still see her as a little girl. So I probably won't say that anymore, but I'm just going to say this young lady. Should I say that?
Yes, you can.
Okay, so she drew her island, and she's into magical thinking, she's into mythical creatures, she's into all that kind of movies and books. She's into that realm, let's say realm. So she took her time drawing her island, really got into the activity. She drew this beautiful kind of magical island with lots of trees and lots of plants, not a lot of animals or anything on there, no other people. She in the middle of her island, she drew one tree, really elaborate tree, and she drew herself next to the tree, leaning on the tree. And so during the exploration of her island and why she drew what she drew, and when I'm asking her, is there anybody else that would be on that island with her? And she was like, no. And I'm like, is there anyone on that island that would visit regularly? And she was like, no. And I said, okay. Who would look after you? And she looked at me and she said, the tree. And I said, but who would give you a hug if you needed a hug? Who would wash your clothes? Who would prepare your food? Who would do all that kind of emotional but also that physical care for you? And she said, well, I would do it for myself or the tree. The tree is all I need in this world. I don't need anything else. I just need that tree. And I was thinking to myself, that's absolutely correct. Makes perfect sense to me that you would say that, because I firmly believe that's your view, because you've never really been able to get your needs met, all of your needs met. She was clearly getting her physical needs met in this current placement. I don't think she was at all getting her emotional needs met, and I don't think she allowed herself to rely on this carer. So she wasn't getting any of that kind of reparative care in my mind, but she was definitely getting her physical needs met, but she did not have any trust in adults at all.
Did that tree and the verbalization of the tree's gonna, meet the needs that I can't of myself? Did that change the carer's engagement in the activity?
No. No, there's a clear disconnect between the carer's understanding of this child's emotional needs and her capacity to meet emotional needs.
And I guess I ask because we can, carers are human like the rest of us, and their window of tolerance, where they're feeling and sitting on each particular day changes just like ours do.
Yeah.
But often when I've encountered carers having not the best day, sometimes like big statements of life on that happen, you see a carer, come back and really engage or respond differently to how they have in the last 25 minutes or whatever. And that's why I ask, because sometimes carers are just having a bad day too.
Of course, absolutely.
That was it.
It wasn't that. It was no, it wasn't that. Part of life story work, as you said before, is you read everything and you have lots of conversations. You know a lot of information, and the carer's behavior is quite consistent with how she has been. Yeah. Yeah, it was very That was very sad. Like, it's very sad to see that, to see a child who is just has no, he's so self-reliant, who just does not have faith that adults in their life will actually be able to support them.
Because of all of their experiences today. And I
Yeah.
think, yeah, you've just demonstrated or highlighted the avoidant attachment really well.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a poster child for avoidant attachment, really. Yeah. All right. How are we going to talk about disorganized?
Well, so I was working with this young man, and he was very close to exiting care. He was sexually abused by siblings when he lived with his biological family, and he lived in his biological family with them until he was about six. And then he was removed and placed into a foster placement where he was again sexually abused and physically abused and neglected. Had a very poor abusive. That placement ended, but not because of the allegations that he was disclosing to people through his behaviors, what was happening in that placement. But that placement ended, and he went into another, well, short-term placement. So at this stage, he's probably in year six, and then throughout his high school journey, he goes from placement to placement. Went into a ICM, which in the state we're in is an intensive care model. I'm meant to be, I believe, like a short-term placement up to 12 weeks, but he stayed in that ICM for 8 months. Then went into another care placement, and then came back into a residential setting. And then when he was just after turned 16, came it to be in a professional care setting. So that's where a carer who has some knowledge and a background in trauma is recruited to provide professional care to a specific young person. So recruited specifically for this young man. And so he went there after his 16th birthday, but was now, 17, nearing leaving care. And it was the first intervention with this young man and his carer, and the agency and the carer had said, let's be grateful if you get 15 minutes with him. Let's not have any high hopes. And so, as a engagement activity, the old Jenga blocks, and oftentimes we both use Jenga with questions. I like purposely took one of the Jenga sets that probably only had five questions max. I was not going to do that to him, having read the history, but wanted to see if I could just engage. So set the Jenga tower up, and he was just, walk and pace and looking around the room, absolutely not engaging in the conversation. And so the Jenga tower is set. Andy walked over and pulled a bottom block out so that
Just so it's over.
it's over. And I laughed. I was like, well, we didn't want to play Jenga. That's a pretty clear indication that that's done. Let's just move along then, shall we? He just kind of looked at me like, whatever. So we've done the explanation for the wallpaper, and I've done the explanation for the island activity. And so the carer, she's drawing her island, I'm doing my island. And he actually did engage in this activity, and his island was very indicative of his disorganized attachment. He was on the island, and it had sharks around the island, rocks that had moss or slime. So even if you somehow got through the shark infested water and to the island on the rocks would like propel you to the water. But somehow, if you made it up the rocks, there was then this kind of dome that sat over the actual grass part of the island. So if you got through the sharks, you're going to hit this force field that was going to repel you in the island. Shark, if you were coming to his island. And he was alone on his island. Obviously, we've got a big pencil case of texters and pencils, and it's rainbow, like pick a color. But the colors were browns, blacks, dark greens, and grays. All the colors that he's using to draw this island. Hadn't really thought about the rules because then we don't need rules because it's again just me. I need rules. Hadn't thought about food. Don't really need to eat whatever. But then later, as the carer's drawing, beautiful veggie gardens on her island, it's very sustainable and lovely. He decides to draw a chute through the magnetic force field so someone can drop food off. Don't know who's going to drop it off. If they don't drop it off, whatever, but if they drop it off, I'll eat it. Like very, very disorganized in how there was no thought. It was just whatever. I'm on this island, I'm alone. I want to repel everyone. If there's food, great, but there's absolutely no people. This young man, though, had a brother and they had not lived together for a very long time. And later added this kind of magic highway to his island for the brother to come, but it was on his terms. My brother can come when I say he can come, and I can reject him from my island in a second, and there will be no speaking. He's just kind of transported off the island. As soon as I say this word, my brother's gone off the island, gone. Very chaotic in the way the description was of the island and trying to understand how you're going to get your needs met or what's going to happen if this happened. Not a whole lot of thought had gone through. I just on my island alone. And it's a horrible place to be, and I'm going to make sure you know it's horrible. And so, got a, stayed in the activity and did complete it until the carer starts talking about, the veggie garden and who's on her island. And she put him on her island, and it was a relatively, new care experience. And he just got up and he went, "Well, you're an idiot," and just walked down the stairs to his room. Wasn't having a bar that he was on this island. And the carer said, I've got this problem. We cook, it was the two of them in the household, but often on particular nights of the week, people would come to join them for dinner, which was part of her strategy to try and widen his circle and also try and make connections for post 18. It was very purposeful, who was coming in on what particular night. And she said, sometimes he'll sit at the dinner table and sometimes he will sit. So they had one of those kitchens with a island bench with stools and then a table behind it. But sometimes he refused to eat dinner with his back to the dining table. So he's eating dinner on the breakfast bar with his back to them. But she's like, there's no pattern, there's no rhyme to this. This is, it's not the same people, it's not on the same night. It's just like I could flip a coin and all of a sudden, he always sat away anyway at the dining table, but then some nights he'll just choose to sit and not engage at the breakfast bar. So I think he's very disorganized in his attachments, given the number of placements and the number of abusive placements he was in. And that I was a stranger at this point in time, that real confusion with me. What are you doing here? And I'm going to tell you without telling you. I'm not into this gender, but I'll do this island. But when my time's up, I'm done and I'm out.
It was really testing, wasn't it? Really, it was, well, not even testing, it was very controlled.
Controlled in a way of like, depending on, I think, how he was on that particular day. That controlled kind of confusing responses, confusing for him, I'm sure, and confusing for everyone around because you never quite know what you're going to get. And it was like that throughout the whole intervention.
Well, I think I said controlled and I should have said controlling.
Controlling, yes.
I think he was very much about controlling the environment, which is such a feature of disorganized attachment, because you have to be able to preempt the harm when before it hits you. So you have to be able to control everyone around you.
Because relationships, they're not safe.
No,
They
they're not.
are very fearful, very unsafe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that feature of control, not feature, that's the wrong word, concept of control, I think undermines so much in terms of the interpersonal interactions that children who've experienced abuse and trauma have with other people. There is always an element of needing to control relationships at all costs, regardless of the attachment style, except of course if you've got a child with secure attachment.
Yes.
Yeah. Which kind of makes me think we should talk about control. What do you reckon?
All of these conversations.
I know. Rose, that was a great example. Thank you for sharing that.
Just think that all four examples hopefully have highlighted the four different attachment types and styles.
Yes.
But also given you a practice example or a tool to use. And it's not to pathologize or to diagnose, it's just to test your own hypothesis and to try and think from a different perspective. How does this child relate?
Yep.
What's their internal working model looking like?
Yep.
You know, and then how am I gonna plan and prepare an intervention knowing this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sense-making lens.
Yes. Two, three words. Much better.
But all theory is a sense-making lens. That's all. That's what theory is about. It just helps you to make sense of what it is that you're seeing at any given time.
Yeah.
So we've just explained how you can adopt that attachment lens to make sense of things and to do, well, as you said before, that forward planning.
Learn.
All right. I think we're done. Are we done?
I think so. I think I have no clue what we're talking about next episode, but we'll get back to you.
Yeah, we'll definitely get back to you. You know, we you just look out for our social media posts and that will let you know what we're going to be talking about next episode. We've got a whole list of things, but also, as we've said before, please, please email us, send us a message, get in contact if there is a particular topic that you would like us to talk about. And share with us a story about why you want that topic to be talked about. We would love to hear it.
Yeah, we enjoy it.
All right. Thank you for listening to Relational Practice Social Work Podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and please hit follow wherever you are listening so other social workers can find out about us. And tune in next episode in 2 weeks' time.
Yes, Cash just wanted to say, see, he's done. He's done with the conversation. I believe Ollie's left your room too. I can't even.
No, he's back, but there's no magpies outside or there's no noise outside that warrants a bark. So I apologize for those two very noisy barks that happened throughout this.
He's done. Well, the dogs have told us they're done. We think we're done. So until next time, stay safe and continue to practice relationally. Bye.
Bye. But maybe someday we'll